Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Attack IQ, and Attack IQ founder Stefan Chanet will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk to us about a few things, the MITRE attack matrix being one of those things. He'll also share with us his view that EDR is the most commonly misconfigured security technology he sees out there, and Stefan has pretty good visibility into things like that because Attack IQ, of course, makes attack simulation software designed to measure the efficacy of these types of technologies. That's coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time to get into this week's security news now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, the five-country ministerial was held recently on the Gold Coast. This was a meeting between the ministers responsible for, you know, public security agencies, domestic security agencies for the Five Eyes countries. That was held on the Gold Coast here in Australia and resulted in a fairly interesting communique being issued.
Yeah, they put out a statement kind of summarizing the position of this particular group, which is made up of, you know, attorneys general and people from Homeland Security, from all across the Five Eyes. It talks about encryption and the interaction of that with law enforcement. And it actually, you know, kind of lays out a fairly straightforward position, which is, you know, we expect to be able to get into the middle of some communications given appropriate warrants, and we expect the tech community to deliver the things that we need, basically. I mean, that's a fair summary, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll read the statement here. The interesting part says, the governments of the Five Eyes encourage information and communications technology service providers to voluntarily establish lawful access solutions to their products and services that they create or operate in our countries. Terrible grammar there, but anyway. Governments should not favour a particular technology. Instead, providers may create customised solutions tailored to their individual system architectures that are capable of meeting lawful access requirements. Such solutions can be a constructive approach to current challenges. Should governments continue to encounter impediments to lawful access to information necessary to aid the protection of the citizens of our countries, we may pursue technological, enforcement, legislative, or other measures to achieve lawful access solutions. So this really is, I think this is interesting because essentially they've just come out and stated their position, right? I mean, that's what it is. Here it is.
Yeah, they have. That basically is, you will find a way to do the things that we expect you to do. I mean, given, you know, we already have legislative ability to go and collect this kind of data, and you'll find us the way to do it. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have to deal and come up with something now, or we will force you. And I think, you know, that's not exactly a surprise. I mean, unless we as a population of democratic countries decide that we're going to, you know, kind of go back and relitigate, you know, phone taps and all of the other sorts of lawful intercept and warranted interception capabilities that we've had, you know, since the dawn of the telephone and the postal age, I guess. Unless we're going to go back and relitigate that away, you know, to the sort of, you know, cypherpunk dream world that we'd all like, perhaps, then we have to kind of accept that we are in the position that we are in, and deal, basically, is what they're saying.
Yeah, now, look, that's my view as well. And instead of arguing about whether or not any form of this is going to happen, I think, you know, really what I'd like to be having is the conversation about thresholds, like universally accepted thresholds for what types of crimes, this sort of access should be enabled for. You know, I'd like to see it reserved for the most serious types of crimes. But, you know, there are a large number of people out there who just do not believe that tech companies should be forced to create any type of capability here. I mean, people often put me in a very pro-surveillance camp. It's not necessarily that. I'm just, it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is complicated. And, I mean, you're right. It would be great that we only use these capabilities where we really, really needed them as a society. Of course, people are legitimately worried about abuse, about overuse, about the depth of reach that modern technology has, therefore, that modern intercept has versus, you know, postal system or phone system, right? Just didn't have the same level of insight, the same level of access to our private lives that technology does. So there is, you know, certainly a very real set of issues that have to be balanced and have to be balanced in a way that respects, you know, democratic society. In terms of actually technically doing the sorts of things that they're asking, I mean, we, the, you know, the Five Eyes nations, you know, we're probably on the more privacy-friendly end of the spectrum compared to, you know, China or Saudi Arabia or, you know, India. We saw India versus, you know, Rim BlackBerry for getting intercept capability there. Like, we are, you know, on the kind of most privacy-friendly end. And the technical capabilities that, you know, that they're going to encourage companies to come up with, let's face it, China is already encouraging to do. India is already encouraged. Saudi Arabia, UAE, we've already seen, you know, what happens when, you know, big corporates are faced with an ultimatum from, you know, the government of their customers. And they already have to build those things, right, one way or the other, whether it's architectural or technical or whatever it is.
Well, and the China thing's a bit of a furphy anyway, because if they see anything on the network that they're having a hard time with, they just block it and funnel everyone through WeChat, right? So this whole idea that, oh, if, you know, Five Eyes countries do this, what about China? China's already up in absolutely everyone's.
Well, exactly, right? And so, I mean, I think the point I was trying to make is that the tech companies have to come up with solutions, or, you know, have them engineered into their faces like China does. You know, they have to come up with them anyway, and then, you know, we in the West are going to get presumably the best of the options rather than the worst that you get, you know, elsewhere where the governments are a little more authoritarian than ours.
Yeah, and, you know, let's just hope that whatever we wind up with, it'll be the providers actually managing these gateways and law enforcement won't have direct access, because I think that's the direction this is going to go.
Well, I mean, certainly if you're someone like Apple or even, you know, Facebook or Google, right, that's how you want it to be. You're going to engineer your architecture so that you retain control and then, you know, provide some, you know, lawful mediation interface for cops and whoever else to get some degree of access, but to control it yourself. And I mean, those kinds of architectural choices hopefully will become the sorts of, you know, things that signal to the market what we should buy if we care about this kind of stuff versus, you know, what we shouldn't buy if it's not important to us, or what we should buy if it's not important to us.
Yeah, I just, I do increasingly have the sense that it's naive to expect that we're not going to see some sort of agreement hammered out or forced upon the tech companies.
I think you're right. I mean, you know, the cypherpunk dreams sadly are to be dashed, right? I mean, it isn't realistic to expect us to have an extreme, you know, an extreme end of the spectrum where a company like Apple is just going to say flat out no, and that there'll be no consequences to that.
Well, and I found one part of that statement very interesting, which is they said that they could pursue technological enforcement, legislative or other measures. Now, technological measures is interesting. I mean, what does that mean? Shells on Open Whisper Systems boxes?
Well, I mean, maybe we've seen technological means used in the past. You know, we've seen, you know, there was some evidence of that in the Snowden docs and that kind of thing where we've seen technical means used.
But that's SIGINT stuff, right? That is SIGINT stuff. This is domestic, very different.
Yeah, you know, you're right. That's an interesting question. What do they mean about technical means for domestic? I mean, I guess owning, you know, buying client-side exploits and owning stuff in the wild to obtain, you know, data from mobile handsets instead of getting it in the network. I mean, that's an example of domestic technical means.
Yeah, I think they mean something else by that. I do. I think they mean they might legislate to indemnify themselves, you know, so that they can go and own providers if they're not complying with various legislation. But anyway, we're not there yet. What we've got right now is we've got the Five Eyes countries and the people responsible for domestic security, police and intelligence agencies saying, you're going to have to take care of this or we will legislate. And that's a very significant thing. Just quickly, Adam, apparently there is a Microsoft Azure outage, pretty big one, affecting all sorts of people.
Yeah. I think there was a lightning strike near one of the data centers in the south central US region of Azure. That took out all of the services from that particular data center. And then they have been having a bunch of issues with some of the ones that are like global services. And in particular, the Azure Active Directory authentication, I think, is causing people.
That's going to really ruin your day, right?
Yeah. Having your AD go away, a little bit of a problem. Microsoft obviously are working on it pretty quickly. They've got a good status page with, you know, quite a lot of green ticks on it, which is very reassuring, but there's quite a few that, you know, are still being worked on at the moment. Yeah, and a bunch of stuff across the internet was kind of flaky today as a result of Azure blowing up. And I mean, to be honest, you know, having a significant swathe of a significant cloud provider blow up and not having the whole internet come to a grinding halt, like, that's pretty
good. It's almost a good news story, isn't it? Yeah, any it word is. On the attribution for the lightning strike yet?
I'm going to blame either God, Yahweh, I don't know who else.
Attributed to God. Okay. We'll
attributed
just,
to God, yes.
Force majeure. We'll leave it at that. ABC News reports and a bunch of outlets have reported on this new FBI website where the FBI is really sort of providing a series of videos for political campaigns, talking them through some security basics. You know, I got to say, it looks like a pretty good initiative.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, you know, ideally they would be beyond the point where they need the basics, but that's clearly not the case. And obviously everybody can benefit from, you know, from some good advice. And yeah, it does seem that by and large they've, you know, got some relatively straightforward, sensible, understandable advice on a number of basic issues, you know, password quality and how to configure your wireless APs right and, you know, using two-factor and all that kind of thing, all explained through, you know, sort of fairly concise videos. So, you know, nice attempt. Hopefully it gets some traction with the people who need to pay attention, but, you know, maybe that's dreaming.
Now, this next one could turn out to be a thought bubble or it could turn out to be very, very consequential. Wired is reporting that Google wants to, quote, kill the URL.
Yeah, we've seen a bunch of reporting about the fact that, you know, Chrome has reached its 10-year birthday and there's a bunch of kind of user interface changes coming along the lines for that. And Wired's got this piece kind of talking with some of the Chrome team about, you know, what's going to happen in the next 10 years. And one of the things that they've, you know, they've tried in a number of guises over the years is to try and reduce the reliance on having to understand what a URL is and understand what that means in terms of where you're going. And increasingly, you know, web applications, you know, the URL is not even really a relevant thing anymore. So, yeah, they're trying to think of a way to kind of more concisely convey to people, you know, where they are and whether they're in the place that they think they are and whether it's safe to be there without expecting people to parse, you know, ridiculous URLs and look at padlocks and all that kind of thing. And, you know, Google's done some work in this area in the past that wasn't particularly well received. On the other hand, they've done a lot of great work with you know, reporting non-HTTPS sites as insecure, which is, you know, clearly a good thing. So, yeah, it's good to see that they're thinking through it. I don't think that the URLs are going to get killed quite as immediately as the Wired headline would want you to believe, though.
But you could imagine for the, certainly, you know, top 100, 500 or 1,000 sites on the internet, you know, maybe instead of showing Facebook.com, they can just show Facebook.
Well, certainly that would make the mobile experience nice. We haven't got much space, but yeah, getting that right and making it work well in all the places that it needs to, obviously that's a thing that's going to take a bunch of work. And, you know, Google's in a good place to do that, given that they have a copy of the internet to work with. So, I mean, I'm sure they'll come up with something.
Now, some news from your neck of the woods, Adam. The mega.nz Chrome extension has been owned, apparently, and is stealing passwords, cryptocurrency, private keys, all sorts of stuff.
Womp womp, yes, the official Mega Chrome extension. It's not entirely clear whether someone's like owned their account on the Chrome store or whether someone's owned Mega or exactly what's going on. Given that it's only the Chrome one and not the Firefox plugin or Firefox extension, I guess it's their account on the
now,
Chrome
Mega,
store.
Now, Mega is the Kim.com thing, right?
That's the, yeah, the successor to Mega Upload run by Kim.com and some of his
couldn't
associates.
Happen to a nicer guy.
Yes, well, I mean, it's embarrassing, obviously, for them. You know, Mega has not. I mean, I guess Mega works all right, but yeah, it has had a bit of a, you know, a spotty history. This is not going to make them look good, especially amongst those people who do cryptocurrency mining, because this particular Chrome extension had been backdoored to not only steal your Mega creds, but also, yeah, like your cryptocurrency wallet keys and logins to cryptocurrency trading sites. In fact, I think it was like some Monero dev guy, a Monero project contributor that actually spotted this and reported it, which, yeah, I guess someone made some good money out of it.
Yeah, and I should point out that that story was written by Catalin Kimpanu, but he is now working for ZDNet. He has left Bleeping Computer and is now working for ZDNet, and he is continuing his role as a one-man newsroom. Like, you just scroll through a feed of stories with his byline on them, and yeah, he's still delivering the goods, so congratulations on the move, Catalin. Now, Germany is launching a cybersecurity research agency, and the funding here looks pretty decent, 200 million euros over the next 5 years. That's a lot of euros.
Yeah, they're talking about this as being sort of a comparable to the US DARPA, you know, organization that funds research and development into technological stuff. In this case, this is focusing on specifically cybersecurity. It's the Agency for Innovation in Cybersecurity. And yeah, the stated goal really is to increase Germany's independence in terms of, you know, security, computer security technology. So they're not, in fact, actually the quote from the interior minister was, so that they're not watching sensitive information technology technology of high security relevance being controlled by third countries, end quote.
Yeah, it's almost like funding the acceleration of balkanization, right?
Yeah, well, exactly right. I mean, it's exactly balkanization, which is a thing we've talked about a bunch over the last kind of, you know, year or so on the show. But yeah, just straight up funding it in Germany. And, you know, it's kind of hard not to agree with them. I mean, it is important to have some independence in this stuff, clearly.
Now, we've seen a man sentenced to prison time as part of the so-called Celebgate, hacks against iCloud accounts, which resulted in, you know, celeb nudes and stuff hitting the internet. I think this is the last person to be sentenced over this stuff. So we can draw a line under it now.
Yeah, finally. It's been a while grinding through the court case. And this particular guy, George Garofano, was arrested when he was back when he was 21. He's now 26. He's been sentenced for 8 months in prison for his role. And as you say, yeah, he was the last of the four people that have faced charges over this. And yeah, I mean, obviously this was a pretty unpleasant story for all of the, you know, the celebrities and people involved. You know, I think this was one of the stories that really did help kind of focus Apple on its role as, you know, having privacy be an important, and privacy and security being an important part of its kind of, you know, image in the market. So, I mean, that's probably one of the good things that's come out of this. But yeah, it's, you know, obviously people who are doing it should perhaps think twice in the future.
Google has released a tool called Broken Type, which is for finding font-based security bugs.
Yeah, this is one of the many kind of security fuzzing tools that Google has released over the years. But yes, apparently this one's done quite well in finding a number of pretty sweet font rendering bugs over the years. Apparently it's been in their arsenal for a few years doing fuzzing stuff and is responsible for something like 20 different bugs in the Windows kernel font renderer and another 20 or so in some of the user land Windows font stuff. So yeah, definitely a tool that has proven its value in battle. So yeah, if you have applications that you're targeting that do render their own fonts instead of using the system stuff, this might well be a thing that's worth having.
I mean, those font kernel bugs are always pretty spectacular.
Yeah, well, I mean, anything that can go from, you know, browser loads a font off the network to I'm a render it in kernel space, you know, that's a pretty useful thing to have on the belt. And yeah, thanks to Google for squashing so many bugs over the years, you bunch of white hat bug killers.
That decision to render in the kernel has been has been responsible for some pretty wild times, you'd have to say, yeah. Over the years, right? Now, you know, some time ago we spoke about how Google is releasing its own security key, which was a bit strange considering, you know, they're heavy users internally of Yubico. And they've chosen a different manufacturer, which is this Chinese company called Feitian. And now there's the inevitable coverage going out saying, well, these things are made in China. Like, do we want to be using them for, you know, high security applications like this? Which I suppose is an inevitable round of coverage that you're going to see with regard to this, but not pointless. I mean, it's a legit concern.
Yeah, it's a very fair question to ask because the hardware supply chain is legitimate, especially when it's a piece of hardware that's dedicated to being a security token. You would expect there.
I mean, you know, China is the country that owned RSA to steal the seed data so that they could bypass, you know, RSA token two factor. So,
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it is a legitimate question to answer. But I mean, then again, on the other hand, so are all the computers that you're plugging them into. Like, those are also all made in China. And I mean, one of the reasons that you have dedicated embedded security processes is so that they are small enough that you can at least attempt to audit them and have some supply chain and have some confidence in their, you know, in their functionality, whereas the entire rest of your computer is, you know, very, very difficult to do so. And Google's done, you know, loads of work over the years on, you know, trying to do good quality supply chain, you know, analysis and understanding where all their code comes from, understanding where all their hardware comes from, understanding where all the firmware comes from. We had a talk at KiwiCon a couple of years ago by one of the members of the Google team that's been working on that for years. So they've done a lot of work in the region. They do kind of understand it. So in that regard, I think the criticism is a little bit, I mean, it's, you know, it's fair in the sense that it's a good question to ask, but I mean, of all the things, it's probably one of the least worst. And Google is amongst the best at kind of doing this kind of, of understanding their supply chain. So it's a little bit unfair. I can imagine there's some saltiness at Google about this particular angle.
Now, we've got another Google-related story here. Google has apparently been notifying people who have been targeted by an FBI investigation.
Yeah, it appears that there was an FBI investigation into a guy who was selling like remote access Trojans. It was called a Luminosity Link. And there was a bunch of people who had been involved in, you know, buying that or interacting with this particular guy. There was an investigation going on by the FBI in the Eastern District of Kentucky that had subpoenaed some information from Google. At some point, the court, you know, lifted whatever restrictions were in place on Google notifying people that their data had been accessed under a warrant. Google has notified their users, and people managed to kind of, you know, fit together what particular case it was, you know, based on the users in question, which, yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like a particularly unusual thing. I'm sure the FBI are investigating a lot of things, and there's a lot of people in the Googles.
Yeah, yeah, it'd just be funny getting that in your inbox in the morning, you know. Oh, okay, right. Little one here from Bleeping Computer, which is, you know, people are frequently misconfiguring their Tor hidden services. And as a result, you know, their SSL certificates are leaking all sorts of info about where they are. And it's all pretty funny. This is some research done by the folks over at RiskIQ.
Yeah, they've basically the methodology here is to scan the entire internet for anything running a TLS web server, pull the certificate out, and then look for certificates that are for .onion addresses.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the obvious thing, right? But they found a lot more than they were expecting.
I think that was the case, yes. But yeah, but the point, I guess, here is not that it's an issue with Tor. It's that people who configure hidden services sometimes don't know what they're doing and let their web server listen on all interfaces instead of just the loopback interface where it would get the connections coming in from, you know, the Tor service that would be delivering the sockets over the Tor network. And yeah, they get caught by correlation of certificates and stuff. So yeah, bit dumb. Don't do that if you run a hidden service.
So many prison years sentenced off basic screw-ups like that, though. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. Right. Oh, now, you know, we covered one of Catalin's stories from ZDNet. Here's one that he wrote, one of his last ones for Bleeping Computer, which is about a couple of attacks on TPM chips. And they're really interesting because they're looking at using power management to kind of screw with the boot sequence of computers and using that to bypass various checks. Really interesting idea. And apparently it's a problem with the spec too. So that's yeesh.
Yeah, this is some really cool research from the National Security Research Institute of South Korea into the way that TPM chips interact with power management on the main board that they're operating in. As with many components on modern computers, they can be put into a low power state, to conserve battery life and that kind of thing. Their particular attacks involve essentially taking a snapshot of the state information that the TPM is storing and putting it to sleep, making some changes to the system whilst the TPM is snoozing, bringing it back up again, and then kind of having the TPM make some assumptions that the state is what it was when it left off. And they've got kind of working examples of this against both statically rooted and dynamically rooted TPM solutions. And it's one of these attacks that's really, really super interesting and great research, and especially because the flaws in question are kind of a function of the spec more than the implementation, I think, was the...
Attacks apparently require physical access. So it's not like this is some, you know, looming threat, but it is just good work, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously these attacks are for pretty niche scenarios, and I mean, you know, the cases where equipment has been seized by law enforcement, they're trying to get in, would be a good example of that, like where you've got physical access to the gear, and it is high value and worth this kind of, you know, sort of exotic sort of attack. It's not a remote compromise or anything crazy like that, but yeah, definitely really interesting research. We're seeing work by a bunch of the vendors to patch the kind of the TPM processes to work around this. Intel and Dell apparently are working on patches, and some of the other vendors are also working on them as well. But yeah, just really interesting research, and you know, obviously TPMs and the kind of the process of TPM attesting the state of your system is really important that we get right if we ever want to trust our hardware or to, you know, increase our ability to think about pretending to trust our hardware. Got to qualify these things, right? It's really great. It's great research, and anyone's into hardware stuff, definitely worth having a squiz through.
And we got some more IoT badware out there, Adam.
Yeah, there's another IoT botnet that's targeting consumer CPE devices from Huawei and D-Link and Realtek and that kind of thing. It's pretty normal stuff, although it's just been picking up a bunch of speed. It's got some exploits for Huawei gear, some exploits for D-Link and Realtek embedded systems. And it's just interesting because the guy that runs this particular botnet was kind of like trolling journalists for press coverage. And then since the arrest of one of the other IoT botnet operators, the one that ran the Satori botnet, apparently this guy has changed his mind about having media coverage. So, yeah, hi, guy. I hope you're enjoying running a botnet for now. But yes.
I hope you're enjoying your days wandering through a fog of paranoia.
Yes, if you're an ISP or, a telco, that kind of thing that runs fleets of these things, maybe, just double check that you're not going to get, 100,000 subscribers or a million subscribers owned.
Yeah. Not a bad idea. Now, I think it was last week or the week before where we spoke about this group called Intrusion Truth and speculated on to who it might be, probably a group of incident responders or something. These are the people going around doxing Chinese operators likely linked to the government. CrowdStrike's weighed in on it. They've written up a pretty decent report here that seems to certainly give a lot of credibility to Intrusion Truth's posts.
Yeah, now this is really interesting because I think it was only last week we talked about this, and it is interesting seeing CrowdStrike registered trademark, Falcon Intelligence trademark, talking through some of the quite specific data points. Because I think when we talked last time, we said we don't have enough information to kind of corroborate some of the specific examples.
Yeah, they've sat down to do it, and it's checking out.
They certainly have sat down to do it. And, they've been through a bunch of the interesting bits, like specifically the Uber records of the guy, taking a cab from his office, which is registered address of a bunch of phishing domains, and going to the Ministry of State Security's office down the road, and correlated pictures from people's social media accounts of the kind of the areas of the town. And, I think the short version of it is that, pretty much everything the Intrusion Truth blog post said seems to line up.
Yeah.
And they've also seen some response from the people who were kind of doxxed in the most recent one, where they've started pulling their profiles and kind of disappearing and trying to scrub some of the things away. So, where there is particular smoke, perhaps there is particular fire in this case.
And I think they've argued a pretty reasonable conclusion here, CrowdStrike, which is that, after the 2015 deal between China and the United States, things did drop off. Things seem to be coming back now, maybe a little tighter in focus and a little bit more disciplined. But Chinese groups are certainly going after US interests again. And it's just an interesting write-up and a bit of fun, right? Like, let's be honest, it's a fun read.
It is a fun read. It's always, interesting watching people have their OPSEC burnt down when they manage to screw it up.
And seeing all their social media pictures, like in CrowdStrike blog posts, right? You don't want that.
Yeah, you really don't want that. And, it's pretty funny read if you're into this kind of attribution. So, yes.
There you go. All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. We'll talk to you then.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. An announcement now. Stephen Ridley and the Exhibitor Senrio team are running some training in New York in November. They'll be offering courses in practical Android exploitation and software exploitation via hardware exploitation. These guys are very well respected in their field, so if you're looking to do some embedded device exploitation training, check out the link in this week's show notes. Okay, it is on to this week's sponsor interview now with Stefan Chanette of Attack IQ. Attack IQ makes attack simulation software, the idea being that you run attack scenarios on your network to make sure those attacks would have failed, the right actions and alerts triggered, that sort of thing. And yeah, they measure the effectiveness of the security controls they're testing against the MITRE attack matrix. You would have heard Adam talk about the attack matrix a few times in the news, so I thought it might be a good idea to get Stefan on to talk about it a bit. And we also spoke about which security technologies are most often failing to do what they say on the box. Stefan says EDR is a sore point out there, not because the software is no good, but because it's frequently being misconfigured. Here's Stefan Chanette.
Yeah, we actually had an employee of Attack IQ that used to work at MITRE and made an introduction about 2 years ago. And what we were looking for was we already had a platform that could validate and measure a security stack of people, process, tools, technologies. But to what end? You have to map it to some type of framework. And MITRE had been working on the attack matrix, right? A knowledge base that described threat behavior and really get to see what adversaries were doing day to day when attacking us. And it was a perfect mapping of, let's take our scenarios that can run against your security defenses, both prevention and defensive, and map it against where you sit, where the gaps are, where the strengths are in the attack matrix. And that's when really everything took off, because it resonated with the security industry.
Well, it is different, isn't it, when you can actually take something and, you know, I mean, the pitch goes from being, can we validate that your security controls are working properly, to can we validate that your security controls are working against these specific criteria created by a respected organization?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what's in the MITRE attack matrix isn't anything theoretical. It's all empirically, you know, documented threat activity that came from both, you know, private and public sector cyber incidents.
Why don't we just take a step back for a moment and sort of explain that framework and that matrix to people who might not have heard about it?
Yeah. So MITRE, first off, is a non-for-profit, you know, research labs on behalf of the federal government. They've come out with a lot of, you know, research and a lot of tools. If you've heard of, you know, Styx and Cybox.
Run the CVE database, right?
So obviously the most well-known. And about 5 years ago, they came out with the attack matrix, right? Which is a knowledge base that describes threat behaviors that we see adversaries using to attack us, right? And what matters most isn't IOCs. It's not the indicators. It's the behavior. And so what they're really describing is, what is the attacker behavior that you're going to see time and time again? I mean, there's thousands of indicators, but right now in the matrix, there's something like 219, 220 TTPs in this matrix, which really helps you focus, you know, what can your defensive stack right now cover? What are the gaps and where are the strengths?
Yeah. So these are 219 individual behaviors, or is it like a sequence of behaviors? How does it really work?
Yeah. So if you look at the matrix across the board, you've got the tactics, right? And so this is the list of problems that really you kind of need to solve. They're the technical objectives for adversaries that they want to achieve. So persistence or lateral movement or data collection. So those are the tactics across the matrix. And then when you look horizontally down the matrix, those are really the techniques that are used to achieve those objectives.
So you might tactic is lateral movement and technique is mimikatz.
Yeah, exactly. Dumping creds and mimikatz is one of those techniques, which used in 80% of, you know, really Windows attacks once post-breach has been achieved.
Okay, now obviously attack IQ, attack simulation, you're trying to, what, simulate these techniques and tactics and then cross off everything on the matrix? Is that the plan? Can you measure against everything there?
Yeah, that's what a lot of organizations today are actually doing. And they're measuring, I mean, there's a number of different use cases for the matrix, right? Actually taking your cyber threat intelligence feeds and describing adversarial behavior in such a way that we can talk about a common language and mapping it somewhere. Where does that threat intel fall in the description in the matrix? You can actually take some of the information, like we were talking about mimikatz, and say, well, let's actually do some adversarial emulation in some of these techniques and measure how we're doing. And it really helps you, you know, as a third use case, organize your defenses, right? Determine where you stand, framing your defensive program against the framework.
Yeah, I can imagine too, like as an output, I mean, the dream output at the end of a test, I'm guessing is going to look like something like the matrix, just actually there with colored boxes, right? Red, yellow, green. Is that sort of the dream scenario there?
Well, that's the dream scenario, right? So you look at a matrix, and today if you go to, you know, attack.mitre.org, you see the matrix, but how do you take that matrix and actually make it actionable or applicable? And really, that's what we've done with, you know, the Attack IQ platform, is we've actually taken all the TTPs in the matrix and actually created a heat map out of it. So you can run all the scenarios, all the TTPs in a do no harm fashion and actually see exactly how you said it, kind of green or red, where your defenses actually have detected those techniques and where they haven't, and then help you prioritize, well, what type of security products or programs should be standing up next. And so it's helping you in almost a prioritization exercise.
Now, that's an interesting thing, right? Because you've tried to be as vendor agnostic as you could be. I've tried to draw you out on this before because, you know, as a company that makes attack simulation software that's designed to test the effectiveness of security software, right? You must have insight into some of the stuff that works well and some of the stuff that doesn't. But it's been impossible to get you to say, right? So instead of asking you about like individual vendors who might be not so flash, can you give us an idea of the most problematic controls in information security at the moment? What are the issues on the matrix that people are having the most difficult time turning green?
Yeah, I mean, EDR, right? Endpoint detection and response is a category of technologies right now that there's a huge amount of budget for, there's a huge amount of spend, there's a huge amount of deployment. There's a number of different vendors in this category. And Patrick, as you said, we're agnostic to all these different companies, but we have integrations for everyone from, you know, Cylance to CrowdStrike to Endgame to Carbon Black to all the vendors. And so on one end, we have all these scenarios, thousands of scenarios that you can replay and really kind of areas of the TTPs in the MITRE attack matrix, and then measure exact technologies with our integrations. And so we're agnostic across the board because we can read directly into a SIEM, Splunk, Curator, ArcSight, and say, well, what technology that you have right now that you think has a certain capability that you can actually validate and prove that assumption is true? And if it's not, it'll help you prioritize, well, what technology should you buy next? And it's nothing against maybe that particular product or company, you might not have configured it correctly, or you're wrong against the capabilities that it actually ever did have. But it helps you prioritize what you're going to be doing next in your security program.
I mean, are you saying that EDR is like kind of a weak point at the moment because people aren't deploying it right?
Well, I think there's a lot of areas because it's so popular right now. There is a lot of misconfiguration in EDR, right? And it just so happens that it's a very popular technology that has a lot of budget, a lot of spend, but there is a lot of misconfigurations. It's highly dependent on. So you look at the endpoint more and more as an area that many organizations are depending on. Because you got that assume breach mentality, which organizations should have. Assume your endpoint is going to be breached. So you have something around the perimeter, and you should. But once it reaches the endpoint, some type of EDR solution that's helping. And so there's a lot of misconfigurations. There's a lot of assumption that something's deployed to 100% of your assets and you're completely wrong. But you don't know that because you're not actually testing, you know, through the attack matrix and through the Attack IQ platform in many cases, the capabilities to say, oh, it's not there, or I'm wrong about a certain assumption, or it's misconfigured. So EDR is definitely an area just because right now there's a lot of focus on it. In terms of the matrix, when we look at it, there's a lot of testing in EDR, but areas like a bootkit loader or something like that, there's a lot of products missing certain areas that kind of drive below kind of the user level of adversarial behavior.
It's funny too, because EDR is probably the most cashed up sector in security, it feels like, at the moment, because it is such a hot line item, if you will. It's sort of surprising that it's the one that falls down.
Yeah, I mean, it falls down because it's misconfigured in many cases.
But do you think, one of my criticisms of EDR generally is that maybe it's a little bit too customizable and powerful, you know?
Oh, that's true. I mean, you look at default configuration and there might be, do you want to actually detect ransomware, or detect is on by default versus prevent? And so, yeah, you have to know how to use these products. But one of the benefits of actually looking at MITRE attack, and then looking at the Attack IQ platform is that's actually how you get to know your technologies even better, right? So when you run a scenario and then you actually go see what does it look like in a particular product, whether that's a web filter or an application firewall or any type of technology, you actually learn your security stack way better by exercising it. And you do that against a framework like, attack from MITRE, and you use that Attack IQ platform to actually exercise all those controls.
Well, I guess this has always been your pitch, right? Which is that you can extract the maximum value out of the kit that you already have. And I'm guessing that rolling attack simulations is going to be a lot cheaper than rolling EDR.
Of course. I mean, you have to look at it like testing maybe a sample set. You might have to only test, 10, 20, 30% of particular network segments, or, your kiosk machines to your financial network. And so you're sampling in many cases statistically across your network segment. And you could do this, periodically on a scheduled basis, every day or every hour, but you can also do it as soon as there's a change to the network. As soon as there's an application changed or security software has been updated, then that's when you go and revalidate. And the way that you get visibility is you look at the heat map within the Attack IQ platform, and that heat map is mapped exactly to MITRE's attack matrix. And you see the weaknesses of the capabilities you assume to have, and whether they're there or not.
All right, Steph and Jeanette, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about the MITRE ATT&CK framework, how you're using it, and also about just a little interesting little diversion there into EDR misconfigurations. That was very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Steph and Jeanette of ATT&CK IQ there. Do check them out at attackiq.com. And what a novelty, a security company URL that doesn't end in .io. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow with some snake oilers. And that is an addition you don't want to miss. We're launching a very interesting company in that episode, as well as talking to Pedram Amini from Inquest about their deep file inspection stuff. That is interesting as well. And there's a third company in there as well, Aculus, and they're applying machine learning to API security. Three very interesting conversations in that one. So even if you're not a tech buyer, that's one that I reckon you should have a listen to because you might find it interesting. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.